From New York Public Radio, this is On the Media. On the Media is produced by WNYC and heard across America on NPR stations. This podcast is made possible by WNYC and its listeners. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The election night graphics had barely faded from our TV screens before the media rushed to explain what the midterm vote meant. That, say, the Republican base voted against their party because it felt betrayed, or that a majority of voters had simply registered their disgust with the war. Other explanations played on the failure of earlier predictions. For instance, the Netroots, the online community of liberal activists, was supposed to carry Connecticut Democrat Ned Lamont to victory over Joe Lieberman. So when Lamont lost, the pundit said that the Netroots wasn't all it was cracked up to be. But Anna Marie Cox, the Washington editor of Time.com, observed recently that many of those explanations are, in fact, myths. She says that to piece together the real picture, consider, for example, how the Netroots candidates actually fared overall.
While it's true that the Netroots became very closely identified with Lamont, they really were more helpful and actually raised more money for other candidates, including Tester in Montana and Jim Webb in Virginia. These are both candidates, by the way, that probably wouldn't have even gotten on the national radar if it weren't for liberal bloggers who really fell in love with them early on. I think if you look at the results of the races that the Netroots chose to identify themselves with, you'll see that either they're doing a better job of picking winners or they have more influence. Either way, that's a significant step forward for them.
Another myth that you observed as proliferated on C-SPAN and MSNBC is the idea that conservative Democrats were elected. You say not so fast.
Well, there were definitely some conservative Democrats elected, Heath Shuler, and also, to some extent, Jim Webb, who actually has a conservative line on immigration, of all things. And there are other people that there are some pro-life Democrats, Bob Casey in Pennsylvania. But on the other hand, there's a bunch of Democrats that got elected that are way to the left, or at least they're part of the sort of old traditional Democratic wing of the Democratic Party, as Howard Dean might say. There's a liberal alternative newspaper editor that got elected. There's a woman who was elected, I believe, in New Hampshire, who was actually once thrown out of a Bush rally for wearing an anti-Bush t-shirt. So these are people you can't actually point to as being very moderate.
There's another idea floating out there, mainly because Karl Rove and the GOP have been floating it, and that is the inevitability of the results, because in any president's sixth year in office, the House of Representatives tends to revert to the party not in power, enabling us all to shrug at these results.
I think that actually this is still a pretty stunning upset for the Republicans, even taking into account the traditional swing back to the minority party in a midterm. The Republican Party worked very hard for the past 2 years, even 4 years, to gerrymander themselves into a position of permanent power. I don't know if anyone recalls all the reasons why Tom DeLay was disgraced, but one of them had to do with gerrymandering Texas. This was done all over the country, and the fact that Democrats got this majority despite having literally, you know, the lines against them, is actually really, really significant.
Your number four could be number one on a lot of lists, and that is the 2006 midterm election being a referendum on Iraq.
Well, exit polling showed that the clear winner when they went into the booths was corruption. The fact that the war isn't going well, I think, is something that a lot of people definitely feel and feel deeply, and definitely something that a lot of candidates talked passionately about. But I think in the end, those swing voters weren't thinking so much about Iraq war. They were thinking about wanting a change for a lot of different reasons.
Now, your fifth myth is the one that, to me, is the most provocative. The idea that Republicans lost their base by straying from conservative values. I think it's provocative because I pretty much totally bought into it?
Well, Rush Limbaugh and Sean Hannity both, the day after the elections, this was part of their post-midterm monologue, when they said the Americans didn't abandon the Republican Party, the Republicans abandoned the Republican Party. You know, they abandoned their principles. Mike Pence, who's a very conservative congressman from Indiana, ran for minority leader under the idea that this was what was going on. I think that, as with many myths, there's a grain of truth to this. There are probably conservatives who look at what happened in Congress in the past 6 years and feel like their leaders did stray. They overspent and they became part of the culture of Washington is the catchphrase that a lot of people like to use. However, that explains perhaps why certain base Republicans didn't vote Republican. That doesn't explain why the large majority of independents broke for the Democrats. The Republicans actually turned out. There was a fear that they wouldn't, and they did. What happened was that independents just acted and thought like Democrats.
Now, among the news organizations that got suckered into the conventional wisdom was, Time Magazine? Now, you're a Time.com contributor. Time Magazine, one of its star political writers, Joe Klein, wrote an analysis piece that you say is really not right.
Well, I think that Joe is a provocative thinker and a great reporter. He was really early out of the gate trying to put a narrative around this election. It was a very unusual midterm. There were races that came out of no one's playbook. I think people are still kind of struggling with how to make it all make sense. And the best that we can do here at Time Magazine or Time.com is tell you what doesn't make sense.
Anna Marie, thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Anna Marie Cox, the pundit formerly known as Wonkette, is the Washington editor of Time.com.
The media love to create narratives about politics and politicians, but since turnabout is fair play, sometimes politicians and pundits craft narratives about the media, the most common being that the media are biased towards the Democrats. The earliest post-election stories did express a certain optimism, as in a USA Today headline stating, quote, "Democrats offer to help steer new course in Iraq." But the tide quickly began to turn, starting with the coverage of Speaker-elect Nancy Pelosi's failed attempt to install ally John Murtha as majority leader. National Journal columnist William Powers would say that the Pelosi storyline is an early example of one of several themes that will shape the coverage of the new Democratic Congress. He calls it infighting. Another theme, Powers says we should expect the media to play upon, is Democrats, quote, running wild.
You know, I think that Democrats thrive in more chaotic environments, and there's a kind of creative chaos that leads to some of their achievements, and I think there's also a destructive chaos where they tend to undermine themselves. And so I was pointing out that despite all the headlines we were seeing about all these wonderful things that are about to happen under the Democratic Congress, I think it's going to be a bit yeastier and, for journalists, frankly, a little bit more fun than that first week of headlines would suggest.
And the running wild storyline, the infighting storyline, relates to yet another storyline, what you call duck soup. These are the Keystone Cop-style pratfalls, the Dean's scream, Kerry's lame joke, that sort of thing.
The point I was trying to make about the Democrats versus the Republicans is that, in my opinion, there is something about the Democrats that is a little bit more Marx Brothers. I mean, obviously the Republicans have these incidents too, Cheney with the gun. I mean, my goodness, you know, that was a John Stewart gift from heaven for weeks. But when it happens to the Democrats, there is something about it where it has a little bit more of an oomph, where it seems to hang around longer and seem to speak to people's funny bone more effectively. I'm not sure why. I think it's related to another point I made in the column, which is the Democratic sort of identity crisis that they constantly seem to be in, this sort of who am I theme of the Democrats.
You date that storyline back to Hamlet, although I think it probably goes back to Oedipus.
Yes. Are they liberals? Are they populists? Are they progressive? Just this whole confusion they have about labels. Beyond calling themselves Democrats, they seem kind of shaky on what they are, whereas Republicans, most of them, seem to be very comfortable calling themselves conservatives. And I think people who have an identity crisis, when they trip, are funnier than people who are not having an identity crisis. You know, and the two parties have different weaknesses. I mean, it's not as if the Republicans don't have their own Achilles heels and so forth. But since the Democrats were the new guys in town and were all over the front pages of the papers and the websites, I wanted to remind people we're back to these motifs and it's going to be interesting and fun.
Interesting, perhaps fun occasionally, but you fall back into a comfortable storyline and you really fail to report the specificity of things. Nancy Pelosi's, quote, inability to count votes seems to be falling into the pratfall category, for instance, and I think it's probably a lot more complicated than that.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is a real hazard of these kinds of motifs where they become so familiar for people who are covering events on short deadline that they fall into them. And I am not for that at all. And when I said fun a minute ago, what I meant by fun was just the kind of tableau of politics, the messiness, you know, the humanity of it, I think is one of the best things about it. And it's something that we don't want to lose in an age when so much political coverage comes from consultants and demographers and these kind of gray sources who are talking basically about data and numbers. And I think we tend to forget that these two parties are cultures and they're made up of human beings. And the strengths and the weaknesses of those human beings, I think, should be a huge part of the coverage because it's the most interesting stuff, ultimately. You know, I got a lot of critical emails on this column saying, how could you possibly enjoy the idea that the Democrats are going to be covered aggressively by journalists when we've just had all these years of Republican screw-ups and bad policy and so forth and so on. But, you know, I really think both parties should be viewed with the gimlet eye by journalists. I think skepticism about people in power is one of the best things about journalists.
Did you think there was a sufficient amount of skepticism about the Republican Congress?
I think there was. You know, I think journalists are more likely to be aggressive about Democratic Congresses than they are about Republican ones, what I call tough love. Because there is this drumbeat of criticism about journalists for being left-leaning.
Right.
And because of that theme, which is now several decades old about media bias, I think when journalists see an opportunity to be aggressive about Democrats, they tend to leap on it.
And you call it tough love. We call it bending over backwards over here. At least that's what we call it on the air.
I call it tough love because, let's face it, all the studies show that journalists do tend to vote Democratic in huge numbers. So there is a sympathy there, a political sympathy. But I don't think it's necessarily reflected in the coverage, and I think we're going to see that in the coverage of this Congress.
I've noticed another narrative emerging right now into full bloom. I wonder if you have. A Monday Associated Press piece described division in the Republican ranks.
Yes, it's the brand new motif. It's wonderful because it's unexpected. You haven't seen that in a very long time, obviously. It feels like a ship that hasn't come on the horizon for decades. And I hope it continues in that it's a great story. I love a great story, and I think that one's very rich. And that particular one that you mentioned had great evidence. And so here's to it.
William Powers is a fellow at Harvard's Joan Shorenstein Center on the Press, Politics, and Public Policy, and a columnist at National Journal. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Up next, on Thanksgiving weekend, we talk turkey.
This is On the Media from NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. 2 weeks ago, the European Union released its long-awaited preliminary report on Turkey's progress in qualifying for EU membership. It was not encouraging. Turkey was found wanting in its treatment of minorities, marginalization of Kurds in the southeast, perceived intransigence over a 30-year standoff between Turks and Greeks in Cyprus, the interference by the military in civil affairs, and, most notoriously at the moment, continued curbs on free speech. That issue raised worldwide condemnation with the prosecution of Nobel Prize-winning novelist Orhan Pamuk. A year ago, after a Swiss newspaper quoted him criticizing the code of silence over Turkey's responsibility for the Armenian genocide in World War I, Pamuk was charged under Article 301 of the Turkish Penal Code with, quote, insulting Turkishness. Those charges were dropped on a technicality, but Pamuk is far from the only victim of Article 301. Last week, Bob was in Istanbul and came back with this report.
This is the ferry boat crossing the Bosphorus from Asia to Europe. See what I mean? A metaphor.
It's a metaphor for the curiosity of being in two places at the same time and the formidable strait to be crossed towards harbor on the western side. Turkey faces many navigational obstacles, not the least among them, Article 301. Enacted in 2005, it was aimed to mollify European skeptics by replacing even more rigid laws that had resulted in wholesale jailing of dissidents and writers for decades. But 301 is so broad and so vague, it's a crime, for instance, to disparage Turkishness, that it has been used by nationalists indiscriminately to punish critics of the government and of the society itself.
It's more than 1,000 individuals who have been put before court.
Eugene Shulgin, a Norwegian novelist, works in Istanbul for International Pen, a non-governmental organization that closely monitors threats to free expression.
We are thinking about names like Orhan Pamuk, like Elif Shafak, some other names. Ragip Sarakulu is one of those who have been sentenced. You have publishers and writers who have up to 20, 40, 50 cases against them.
The first of these was publisher Ragip Zarakola, who ran afoul of 301 by publishing the diary of an Armenian doctor who, in his role as a Turkish officer, witnessed his own forces annihilate the city of Smyrna in 1922. 83 years later, those observations were deemed an affront to national dignity.
I was accused in defaming Turkish army and Turkishness. You can accuse everybody to defaming Turkishness. It's a strange definition of a crime.
He's getting accustomed to the strangeness, however. Unintimidated by the censors, he has been prosecuted 35 times for treading on Turkey's sacred taboos.
Taboos like Armenian taboo, Kurdish taboo, minority rights taboo, also the impunity of the state.
The impunity of the state, which embraces not just the elected government, but the judiciary, the bureaucracy, and especially the military, is a particular trap because it can easily criminalize the most basic sort of journalistic criticism. İsmet Berkan is the editor of the moderately leftist daily Radikal. I asked him to tell me his story.
Which one? Because I prosecuted many times. The last time I was accused of insulting the Turkishness, three big universities in Turkey tried to make a seminar on the Armenian issue.
The Armenian issue. He refers to the ultimate taboo, the murder and deportation of up to 1 million Armenians by Ottoman Turk forces and their proxies during World War I. The courts ordered the symposium canceled, and when Berkan criticized the decision, he was prosecuted. You might wonder, in a country trying to integrate with Europe, how that can be. The answer is complicated. A big factor is the heavy hand of the military, which has staged three coups since 1960 and an essentially invisible ongoing coup over the past decade. The constant threat of takeover severely limits the options of the moderate Islamic government and imposes a sort of shrugging reticence among the people. International Pen's Eugene Shulgin.
The silent majority is so silent. It's very difficult to really interpret what they think, but they are used to keep their mouth shut.
Turks for centuries were ruled by sultans. Fealty, as one businessman put it to me, is in our DNA. And it is that lingering connection to the bygone empire that is being exploited by allies of the military wishing to drive a wedge between Turkey and Europe. Joel Campagna is senior coordinator of the Middle East for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
Nationalist forces who are against Turkey's membership in the European Union and who see that as a threat to Turkish independence and national identity have essentially tried to use the judiciary as a way to embarrass the government and to make it look bad in terms of its attempts at membership in the European Union.
Europe's increasing impatience with Turkey, in turn, is used to fan popular resentment in a former empire now reduced to the role of supplicant. In other words, sabotage, not only of negotiations with Europe, but of free expression itself. Joel Campagna.
Self-censorship is one result. I think these types of prosecutions, even if they are prison sentences that are suspended and the journalist or writer is not forced to serve those sentences, I think they do at the same time send a strong signal to potential critics. And I think that's troubling.
Always we journalists must be careful.
Orhold Salaslar is a columnist for the daily Cumhuriyet. He's been jailed twice for a total of 3 years, and he's careful not to ask for further trouble. For instance, he will never refer to the Armenian issue as a genocide.
Because if you use these words, the people don't want to listen to you. For so many years, there are not any hard case against me. Because when you learn how to write, because we lived under the coup d'etats, under the military systems, so many years, we learned. But I can say openly, I can write what I want. But sometimes I use some way.
Byzantine.
Yes.
But the problem with 301 is that caution is not enough, because the most innocuous reporting can get you in big trouble. Salaslar's wife, Ipek, awaits trial for an anecdote in a biography of the wife of Kemal Atatürk, founder of the Turkish Republic. She recounted an incident from the 20s when Atatürk had to sneak out of the presidential palace clad in a woman's chador to escape assassins. This was deemed an insult to Atatürk's memory, and she faces 4.5 years in prison. As nutty and reactionary as that may sound, though, even among journalists, there is an ambivalence about Article 301. Oktay Ekci is a columnist for Hürriyet and chairman of the Turkish Press Council. He lobbied against 301 when it was being drafted, but now doesn't necessarily believe it should be repealed.
That's true. We wish it to be amended rather than abolishment. For instance, in the article, it says that Turkishness is a value that cannot be attacked or insulted. We say that this is a very vague definition. Instead, for instance, we claim that it should be Turkish nation.
Trying to parse the difference between insulting Turkishness and insulting the Turkish nation is like navigating the linguistic Bosphorus. It reminds you of the unique place Turkey holds astride the borders and values of East and West. The country is at a crossroads, yes, but stroll any one of Istanbul's colorful bazaars, this place has always been a crossroads, hasn't it?
The Egyptian bazaar has been a free market for 400 years.
Alas, more for spices and textiles than ideas. Yes, Turkey is clearly leaning westward. And yes, progress has been made. 10 years ago, according to the Reporters Committee, Turkey imprisoned more journalists than any country in the world. Today, in spite of 301, only a handful. Still, the strait has not fully been crossed. On December 15th, the European Union wants to see evidence from Turkey that it has progressed on a checklist of mainly human rights issues. On that same day, publisher Ragip Zarakola will be in court to explain why a century-old diary of a Turkish massacre isn't a crime against the modern state. If he fails, he'll go to jail.
And now for a couple of letters pertaining to Bob's interview last week with CNN TV staple Lou Dobbs. Joe Felice of Brooklyn writes, I don't even agree with Lou on immigration or watch his show, but he defended himself splendidly in what felt a lot like a cross-examination. The media is full of dogmatic blowhards sounding off on the headlines with zero expertise and total predictability. In that context, Dobbs' comparative smarts and his propensity for positions across the political spectrum make him a net asset. And this from Julie Pfeiffer. Am I the only one who noticed the extreme irony of the juxtaposition of two segments aired in today's episode? First, you played a largely respectful interview with Lou Dobbs, whose inflammatory and populist broadcasts are attracting an ever-widening audience as they air on one of the most ubiquitous cable TV channels in the United States. Immediately thereafter, you featured the introduction of cable channel Al Jazeera English, focusing for nearly the entire piece on the fact that Al Jazeera Arabic's occasionally inflammatory and populist broadcasts have kept the new channel from receiving a single cable distribution agreement in the United States. If the U.S. public can be trusted to watch Lou Dobbs and his nativist hate speech, why can't we see Al Jazeera English, which is far less polemical? Keep your comments coming to onthemedia@wnyc.org, and please don't forget to tell us where you live and how to pronounce your name. Last week, two of North Carolina's largest newspapers, the Charlotte Observer and the Raleigh News and Observer, apologized in separate editorials for their part in a little-known chapter of American history. 108 years ago, and for several years, a biracial coalition of Republicans and populists had controlled two Senate seats, the governorship, and a majority in the state legislature. Supporters of the so-called fusion movement were mostly white, but in a number of counties, black men held elective office too. All that came to an end on one bloody November night in what came to be known as the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898. Spurred on by the local press, white mobs set fire to black-owned businesses and overthrew the city's own fusion government. They killed dozens of blacks and ran thousands out of town.
In the year 2000, a state commission finally was created to investigate the episode. It concluded that what happened that night in Wilmington was not so much a riot as an insurrection, a coup d'etat orchestrated by prominent members of the Democratic Party. They wanted to topple the fusion government, and though they had big business on their side, as well as a number of regional papers, that wasn't enough. They needed the poor white farmers. And so, says Duke Professor Timothy Tyson, the Democrats used the printing press to paint the conflict in black and white.
The goal was elite rule. Racial rhetoric and racial violence was a tool to that end. What you had to do then was to shame white men who had voted with black men and say that they had failed to protect their women folk. Right. So they put this red-hot, scurrilous, very sort of sexually oriented, near-pornographic material out in the newspapers about the sort of black beast, black brutes, especially in the counties that had heavy black majorities. They tried to shame white men into voting race instead of sticking with their economic interests.
Can you give me some specific examples of headlines or articles or cartoons that were inciting violence and racial hatred?
Well, for example, there's a cartoon of a big black vampire-like thing with wings, the incubus of Negro domination, you know, carrying off white women in its claws. The News Observer would run a cartoon of a white woman taken before a black magistrate, for example, and the black magistrate, you know, being licentious as if, you know, oh, you're in trouble, are you? And then acting as though they would be sexually taking advantage of this. They interpreted any kind of self-assertion on the part of black men as really being about sexuality, you know, about taking white women.
There's a temptation to see this as kind of an interesting historical footnote, but it's more than that. It was really a watershed event for the politics and governance of North Carolina for a century.
Oh, this is the most important political event in North Carolina's history, with the exception of the Civil War. When we had a coup in North Carolina and the federal government did nothing. President McKinley never even uttered the word Wilmington. What that did was send a signal that you can run black people out of public life in the South, no holes barred, and we quickly see this happening. Georgia had a very similar campaign in 1906 that was really modeled on what had happened in North Carolina quite consciously. That becomes the heyday of lynching. This becomes the time of disfranchisement all across the South where black people lost the vote. So it's not just a North Carolina event. It's really an event of national importance.
And the newspapers in Georgia and elsewhere in the South, did they mimic the News and Observer and its racial browbeating?
The News and Observer, the Atlanta Constitution, the Times-Picayune in Louisiana, the Washington Post, all of really sort of the Democratic Party papers of that era follow this line. And this campaign broke a lot of ground with that, actually, because you don't see this type of stuff during slavery, for example. You don't see this idea in the white media that somehow the enslaved black men are a threat to white women. But when black men wished to be citizens, somehow the closer a black man got to a ballot box, the more he looked like a rapist. And you see these same images echoing into the 1970s and beyond.
Now, the commission didn't simply report what happened in this remarkable bit of history. It also offered suggestions for concrete steps that local government could take to begin to right some of the wrongs, reparations for heirs of victims and for minority business grants and so forth. But also, it suggested that the newspapers, which exist today under very different ownership and different ideology, should also address their own complicity with minority scholarships and, of course, a commitment to write about this chapter of history. Do you believe that newspapers should be in the reparations business?
I don't know. Honestly, I don't think that private payments to individual citizens are really going to do much to fix the damage that's been done. And I would also just say that the News and Observer, really, since 1998, on the 100th anniversary of the Wilmington Race Riot, has spent a lot of newsprint reporting on their own role back in the white supremacy revolution. The Greensboro paper and the Charlotte paper have done the same thing. So I don't think that they bear any great stigma. They've been very honest about how things were.
Well, Tim, thank you very much.
Thanks, Bob. Enjoyed being with you.
Timothy Tyson is senior scholar for the Center of Documentary Studies at Duke University. He's also the co-author with David Soselsky of Democracy Betrayed, the Wilmington Race Riot of 1898 and its Legacy.
Coming up, the Tao of the Talking Head.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. Online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Kauffman Foundation of Kansas City, featuring a new book by Carl Schramm, The Entrepreneurial Imperative, at kauffman.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, exploring how technology is changing kids and learning, at digitallearning.macfound.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Every so often, we consider words or phrases that bubble up through the media, and one locution that has been percolating in recent years is mainstream media, an old term with a new political status. The supposed decline of mainstream media is a favorite topic of Fox News. Here's Bill O'Reilly, John Gibson, regular guest pundit Laura Ingraham, and Bill O'Reilly.
Personal story segment tonight. While many Democrats are running away from the John Kerry controversy, as we said, the mainstream media can't run. They have to report.
The mask is now off. The mainstream media, typified by the big three newscasts, rooting for the Dems to win and slant coverage to make it happen.
Every election cycle, the dinosaur media, the old media, gets more partisan than the election before it. In every election cycle, I think the mainstream media's influence diminishes, and they don't seem to understand.
So the anti-Simpson movement, ironically, is being driven by the tabloid press and traditional commentators like me. The mainstream media, well, they're watching from afar, hoping the judgmental aspect of this situation doesn't blow back on them.
In that last clip, O'Reilly ingeniously suggests that the mainstream media somehow back O.J. Simpson's recent marketing blitz. By the way, Simpson's book and TV interviews, both canceled, were bankrolled by Fox Uber boss Rupert Murdoch. But that scenario fits into the meaning of the phrase mainstream media that prevails on Fox News and elsewhere as a cauldron of amorality out of touch with the conservative majority. Author Bob Kahn, staunch critic of the New York Times, put it this way on The O'Reilly Factor.
You know, the mainstream media has had a monopoly over the setting of the news agenda for over 30 years. And now with the advent of talk radio and TV cable news like the Fox News, they don't have that monopoly anymore.
In his formulation, mainstream media, or MSM, does not refer to Fox News, America's most watched cable news channel. New York University journalism professor Jay Rosen, who authors the blog PressThink.org, says the term is fatally imprecise, and he's coined his own, legacy media. Like the legacy airlines.
Well, they resembled the legacy airlines because they are, in a sense, saddled with an outdated or heavy infrastructure in an age when to be nimbler and lighter might be a lot better.
You conceded in your column that the airline industry's legacy carriers have been pretty much given up for dead.
Right.
Do you forecast the same fate for the MSM?
No. But I think they have to realize that adapting to a new world is critical now. And that certain notions, certain standard practices, things they've lived with, grown up with, might in fact be tossed overboard. The philosophy of objectivity and neutrality now has to be stretched over like conflicts in politics that are so deep that the one hand and the other hand reporting, he said, she said, it's like a escape from truth rather than a measured tone of truth, a kind of a silence that journalists have practiced, that others are now filling in.
We know the networks are mainstream media. We know the newspapers are mainstream media. But
right.
How about cable? Or is it everybody on the one side is mainstream media and bloggers, the citizen journalists, the independents on the other side are not the mainstream media?
When I use the term, I mean the professional culture of the press as it extends over a lot of different media outlets. But it depends on where you are in the media food chain, what you mean by mainstream media, that has a lot to do with it. It's a term to designate an other, and especially in blogging, that's what it is. It's the other. It's what you're reacting against. It's also what you're reacting to.
It's them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So as a word, it's essentially a moving target.
Floating signifier, we call it in the university. Yeah.
And possibly even a product of an increasingly paranoid culture, because it seems to me that it's almost always invoked as a pejorative.
Associations with cluelessness do cling to this term.
Cluelessness, but also extreme capitulation on the left or the right. I mean, when Bill O'Reilly refers to it, he talks about a liberal media establishment that's not only out of touch but pernicious. And when people on the left talk about it, they talk about one that is wholly owned by corporate interests and the right and is antithetical to the goals of democracy.
You know, Brooke, as we're talking about this, it's occurring to me that part of why this term mainstream media came about is that a lot of different people could say what was ending. The world of the mainstream media began unraveling in the mid-70s when cable television began to enter American life. And this limited range of choices started to expand dramatically. And the internet came along and took all of those people who for so long had been the audience of the media and connected them to one another. For the year 2004, for people on the cultural and political right, the red state of America, MSM was a very concrete, real, almost sensuous thing. It was not at all an abstraction. And I think people are going to remember 2004 and the politics of that year partially with those initials, MSM.
New York University professor Jay Rosen authors the blog PressThink.org.
Freelance journalists who seek to make their mark or just want to pump up their brand to keep assignments flowing sometimes moonlight on the networks and cable news channels as pundits. Not just freelancers, of course. The airwaves are abuzz with media personalities of all stripes, including print and radio reporters pulled from their desks and parked awkwardly in front of the cameras. It's not an easy transition, to be sure, but now there's help. A Washington public relations firm is offering journalists with little or no TV experience some training for their star turns as talking heads. Last year, we sent our own John Solomon to pundit school, and he came back with this report.
I was once a promising TV pundit prodigy. At age 13, I appeared as an imposter on To Tell the Truth, the old game show where contestants who are not experts try to play one on TV. In my episode, I pretended to be a hot young painter.
Number two, what is your name, please?
My name is Volodek Kuss. This black and white painting...
And to know enough about art to fool the celebrity panel, including Nipsey Russell.
All right, number two, do you do all abstracts or do you do some representational things?
I'm an abstract painter, but occasionally I'll do things that follow up
In the midst of my abstract answer, Nipsey jumped in and rescued me.
I see. Who is your favorite painter, number two? I'm still talking with
Jackson Pollock.
I see.
I didn't convince Nipsey, but I did get panelist Bill Cullen's vote.
That is number two. I think number two has it very well thought out. And,
host Gary Moore seemed to hint at a limitless TV future.
The rest of us, too. What is your real name? What do you do?
My name is John Solomon.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. And the same goes.
However, it took me more than two decades to return to the tube. Fox News Channel invited me to talk about an article I had written for USA Today on a potential baseball strike.
Welcome, everybody. I'm Neil Cavuto, and this is Your World. My next guest says that a strike would be a good thing. He's John Solomon. He's a sports journalist right here in New York.
I say the sport needs a strike. Right now, they're negotiating really a very stopgap situation.
I was not invited back. So when the folks here at On the Media signed me to do a story about a Washington, D.C. company that was training journalists for TV punditry, I saw it as an opportunity to jumpstart a career that had peaked just before my bar mitzvah. On the train down, I heard someone a few seats back speaking on his cell phone. He said, "Well, Tina heard me talk about Enron at a dinner party and asked me to be on the show next week." Was there a real-life TV pundit aboard my train? I turned around. It was Joe Nocera, a longtime print journalist currently at the New York Times, knows Sarah moved into radio as a commentator for NPR's Weekend Edition Saturday and now is a regular on TV. He tried to put me at ease about my own potential transition.
When people ask me why I'm so relaxed on television, I just say it's simple. The stakes are so low. What is there to be worried about? For so many of these shows, the audiences are pretty small because the knowledge required is so minimal, this isn't always true, but a lot of times the hosts are idiots.
Now, Sarah quickly added that he wasn't referring to Tina.
Ladies and gentlemen, next station stop will be Union Station, Washington, D.C.
As Nocera and I walked off the train, the first person I saw was an old college acquaintance. I hadn't seen him since he was on TV as a legal pundit during the Clinton impeachment. He has since returned to real law and didn't want to be interviewed. As I continued through the station, I recognized yet another face from cable. Joe Watkins, a conservative co-host of CNN's Crossfire.
I mean, should you feel somewhat bad if you haven't been on TV and you're in Union Station?
They're everywhere.
A few weeks before, I had asked Watkins co-host Paul Begala whether a class at Pundit U could make a good Crossfire guest out of me.
No. Maybe you either got it or you don't.
If I had it, I would find it in the 1,000-square-foot mock TV studio located at the downtown offices of Corvus Communications. I was welcomed by my punditry professor, Rich Masters, a gregarious 42-year-old former rock disc jockey, local television reporter, and U.S. Senate aide, Natalie attired in a tan pinstripe suit and ostrich skin boots. Masters sat me down on a chair about 10 feet in front of a video camera. He fit me with an earpiece.
Yeah, this is a baseline. So feel free to screw it up so that you look really great when it's all done.
He then disappeared into a sound booth. Suddenly, Klieg lights clicked on from above. The next thing I heard was...
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Late Edition. John Solomon, will Tom DeLay survive?
I think Majority Leader DeLay's days are in fact numbered, and
I was in a spiral, and Nipsey Russell wasn't around to bail me out.
He'll be gone. He's doing as well as I am doing right now.
Well, I guess only time will tell. Thank you again, John Solomon, NPR, for joining us.
The Klieg lights were switched off.
That just to show that was for the baseline, to really...
Thank you, very perfect.
Next, Masters gave a PowerPoint presentation with some pundit do's and don'ts. Sample do, prepare and practice in advance. For each likely question, create what Masters calls message diamonds, which should include your main point, then a lively anecdote, and finally the same point repeated in a slightly different form. Sample don't, a pre-show cocktail. Masters made that mistake himself and ended up inventing a new word, authentication, live on Fox's Hannity and Combs. Now briefed and still sober, I return for another appearance on fake live TV.
Welcome back to MSNBC. Gun owners have long complained that they don't get a fair break from the media. National Public Radio's John Solomon went into the field to find out what the problem was.
After I finished explaining what the problem was, we went into a conference room to replay the tape so Masters could show me, on a huge plasma TV screen, what my problems were.
After the election, there was a big hue and cry about the fact that the blue state media didn't understand the red states. And one of the big issues was guns.
Masters froze the frame.
A couple things. Energy a little bit. As you can see from this, there's a need for makeup.
The plasma TV had also apparently sucked all the blood out of my alarmingly peaked face.
Because you can't control the sweating thing, but you can see you got a little bit of a 5 o'clock shadow. But you have a little bit of a head bobble thing, a kind of little bobble head thing, but not as bad as I've seen a lot of folks have it.
He turned back to the screen and pressed the remote.
I think a lot of people view gun owners as people who are unsafe. But in fact, when you're around gun owners, you find that they're as concerned with safety because, in fact, they're going out hunting with their relatives or their family. And in fact, safety is paramount to them. So
I told Masters that at NPR we got a $10 bonus every time we used the phrase, in fact.
No, mine's clearly. I say clearly 1,000 times in a 2-minute deal. Word crutches, there's nothing wrong with them.
He said it gives you time to get ready for what you'll say next. But in fact, that was my biggest problem.
I realized that every time I added more, I got myself in trouble. Is that a common thing where you kind of hit it nicely, you get a nice little double, and you go for the home run, and you start wandering, and you say, why did I add it? I was so doing well, and then or decently.
That's absolutely common. Television ain't splitting the atom. You want to get in and out. It's laser surgery, baby. You get in and out, and you just keep it as tight as you possibly can. When you feel that need to take it one step further, that's when you're going to end up rambling.
Master said I also needed to bring some of my personality on the air with me.
Sitting here, you've got just this great energy, engaging talk, and watch this. It drops off. Your energy level drops off a full quarter, if not more than that.
Because, in fact, there is much more common ground on this issue than has been portrayed in the press.
Thank you, John Solomon, National Public Radio.
Thank you.
The screen went black, and I awaited my final evaluation. Was I any good at this TV thing? I used to be.
You're a good contestant, I'll tell you that. So
I was excited when Masters asked if he could use part of my performance as a model to show future students. Until I found out what part.
Majority Leader Delay's days are in fact numbered, and we'll be.
That would be a brain freeze.
A brain freeze.
That's what we call the Solomon.
Still, Masters saw enough potential in the full Solomon that he offered to pitch me to talk show bookers. It turned out I didn't need his help to get my next TV interview about another type of delay. The following morning, I was waiting in Union Station because brake problems had caused rail cancellations all along the Northeast Corridor, and a local television reporter was looking for reaction.
Live from the area's leading news station, this is News 4 at 4.
Amtrak's Acela trains are still out of service. Some passengers at Union Station this morning had to switch to regional service, which makes more stops.
So I upped my energy, answered concisely in message diamonds, and I had just shaved. Soon, I would no longer be the only one in Union Station not recognizable from TV. But alas, my interview didn't make it on air. A few days later, I got an email from Joe Nocera informing me that he too got bumped. At the last minute, Tina Brown had decided to switch the panel discussion from Enron to Michael Jackson. Well, Joe, I guess that's television. For On the Media, at least for now.
My name is John Solomon.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Megan Ryan, Tony Field, Jamie York, and Mike Vallo, and edited by Brooke. Dylan Keefe is our technical director and Jennifer Munson our engineer. We had other engineering help from Bill O'Neill and more help still from Alicia Rebensdorf and Michael McLaughlin. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Katya Rogers is our senior producer and John Keefe our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find free transcripts, MP3 downloads, and our podcast at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
Thanks for checking out this week's On the Media from WNYC, New York Public Radio. Support your local public radio station. Visit onthemedia.org to find where On the Media is playing near you. And please help support this free service by becoming a member of WNYC at WNYC.org. And thanks.
NYC Now delivers the most up-to-date local news from WNYC and Gothamist every morning, midday, and evening. With three updates a day, listeners get breaking news, top headlines, and in-depth coverage from across New York City.
By sponsoring programming like NYC Now, you'll reach our community of dedicated listeners with premium messaging and an uncluttered audio experience. Visit sponsorship.wnyc.org to get in touch and find out more.